Good afternoon. My name is Courtney Kendall from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar. We're excited to have you with us today. We will allow a few more minutes for people to call in and log on, so while we wait, I will go over some logistics, and then we'll get started with today's webinar. First, I want to mention that everyone is on listen-only mode, and this presentation will be recorded. You have two options for how you can hear today's webinar. In the upper right corner of your screen, there is a box that says audio mode. This will allow you to choose whether or not you want to listen to the webinar through your computer speakers or a telephone. As a rule, if you can listen to music on your computer, you should be able to hear the webinar. Select either use telephone or use mic and speakers. If you select use telephone, the box will display the telephone number and specific audio pin you should use to dial in. If you select use mic and speakers, you might want to click on audio setup to test your audio. We will have a question and answer session at the end of the presentation. You can participate by submitting your questions electronically during the webinar. Please do this by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen on the right-hand side. There you can type in any question that you have during the course of the webinar. Our speakers will address as many questions as time allows. So again, welcome to today's webinar titled Demand for Transmission, Roles and Interactions of PUCs, IRPs, and PPAs. This webinar is the fourth in a series of webinars given in cooperation with the Bureau of Land Management and NREL. This webinar series has been developed to inform as many federal agencies, staff, and managers as possible regarding electric transmission markets, electric grid overview, transmission planning, transmission permitting, as well as construction and maintenance activities. Let's go ahead and get started. We have two speakers today, Carlin Corey and David Hurlbut. Carlin Corey has over 17 years of experience analyzing renewable energy policies and U.S. electricity markets. She has an in-depth understanding of investor requirements to get renewable energy projects financed, as well as experience identifying best practices for policies that can be used to encourage increased capital for renewables. Ms. Corey also has extensively evaluated renewable energy certificate market for renewable portfolio standards and voluntary green power markets, and more recently has examined feed-in tariff policies in the U.S. and Europe in detail. Ms. Corey has performed several analyses that combine her knowledge of federal and state policies and incentives to investigate their impact on various financing structures for renewable projects. She has a master's in technology and policy from MIT and a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from Tufts University. And our second speaker today is David Hurlbut. David is a senior analyst in NREL's Market and Policy Impact Assessment Group. He is one of NREL's experts on electric utilities, regulatory issues, market design, and electric sector transformation. He is leading NREL's participation in interconnection-wide transmission planning work funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for the Western and Eastern interconnections. He is also working with the Department of the Interior on a study of clean energy alternatives for the Navajo Generating Station, which is the West's largest coal-fired power plant. Prior to joining NREL in 2007, he was a senior economist at the Texas Public Utilities Commission, where he was involved in market design, market monitoring, and enforcement against anti-competitive behavior. With that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it on to Carlin. Carlin?
Great. Thanks, Courtney, and it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for joining us. So the next slide shows the objectives. What is it that we're going to talk about today? I haven't been involved in your other webinars, but I've seen you are covering a great deal of detail and really getting a great overview of what it takes to build new transmission. So we're going to review some of the key concepts seen in some earlier webinars, RPSs, renewable portfolio standards, as well as transmission planning. And then we're going to add some new key concepts. That's really the meat of what we're getting at here. It's a bit of acronym soup, so please bear with us. We're going to talk about IRPs, integrated resource plans, PPAs, power purchase agreements, and PUCs, public utility commissions. In some states, they're called PSCs, public service commissions, or other variants on that. And then we'll overview the IRP process. We'll talk about how PPAs are generated and the role of the PUC in improving the IRP. And again, if you have questions along the way, please feel free to submit them to Courtney through your box in the upper right-hand corner, and we will address them at the end. So Renewable portfolio standards, these are renewable mandates, which are prominent across the United States. 29 states and the District of Columbia have RPS policies that are mandatory, and 7 have non-binding goals. This is really the reason why a lot of renewable generation and capacity is being installed in the United States today. Prior to RPS policies, there wasn't the level of investment and deployment that we are seeing today, and therefore these policies are seen as fairly successful. One thing I will note on the next slide is that just because a particular state has an RPS policy doesn't mean that that is necessarily where the project will be developed. So there are some historical power flows in the Western Interconnect. This I've taken from an upcoming NREL report, and it shows how there has been sharing of power between states. So there have been multi-state compacts in order to transfer energy from states to different states. That is still the case today. So for the RPSs, we might see that of an RPS itself, it has really, really great wind resources. And so they will transfer that to other locations, including Colorado. What about the future? Well, these pending transmission projects help to take a look there. Certainly any transmission which is completely full, it'll be more challenging to site and locate a renewable plant on those lines. It is easier if there is a new line which is being developed. And so these transmission projects are pretty important for the potential growth of new renewable projects as well as other conventional generation in the West. But what are the realities of planning transmission? It's a bit of a chicken and egg proposition. The question always is, who will build first? Typically, the development cycle of a renewable energy project, solar, wind, are a little shorter, geothermal and concentrated solar power a little bit longer, probably even longer than the 3 years listed here. But transmission can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years, and even longer, in definitely in California and other locations. So is the utility really going to build a line bigger than needed, hoping that more generators will come? In general, the answer is no. Their regulators are concerned that they're doing something that is imprudent and therefore may not allow them to get recovery for the cost that they're putting out. But as you've seen, the generators have a shorter development cycle. So are they going to build and then just hope that the transmission will get there? That would add on another 5 to 10 years to their development cycle. And then there are other questions. Does the first generation plant pay the full cost of new transmission and the required upgrades? A recent FERC order indicates that they shouldn't. That has not yet been fully fleshed out in terms of how it will be dealt with across the United States. So that's something that we're waiting to see, and it'll be interesting to see as the different regions kind of roll out their plans for implementation, how that's going to affect transmission planning and transmission builds. And then finally, cost allocation issues are really important. So no matter what is built and when it's built, who's going to pay? Is it some combination of the generators, the utility, and the ratepayers? And how do you allocate the costs between those parties? So transmission planning can be quite challenging, and I think what we'll talk about here is how the regulators, the state regulators specifically, really play a role in terms of developing them. So the first key concept, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through some of these key concepts. We're trying to lay out some definitions just so that you have a better sense of, you know, what these terms mean. And then I'll hand it over to David, and he'll walk through how the terms and the entities relate to each other. So the first key concept is the Integrated Resource Plan. It's a public planning process and framework in order to evaluate utility resource options to meet demand. What does it mean? It means that the utility might have load growth happening, and they need to figure out how much power they need in order to meet that growth, and if the power is located in certain places, what transmission needs to get built in order to connect that to the load. It's a process that utilities and regulators go through. It looks both at the short term as well as the long term. And again, like I said, it's really analyzing the cost of and the benefits from both supply side and demand side options. You might ask yourself, what's a demand side option? That could be something like a demand response. So instead of building a new physical generating unit, you set up a demand response program that will allow large industrial or large commercial customers to bid in or back down their load in order to really participate in the market. This can include environmental impacts, energy efficiency, and renewable energy alternatives. Next slide. So the next key concept is the power purchase agreement. This is a contract to purchase electricity or power. It's between the utilities and the independent power producers. Sometimes utilities own the power plants themselves. For renewable electricity, the vast majority in the United States is owned by independent power producers. When? These are long-term contracts, typically anywhere between 10 and 25 years. For renewables, they tend to be a bit longer because the capital costs are higher, and you need to levelize that out in order to get a PPA price that is acceptable to the regulators. So why do you do that? To secure investor capital to build the plant in the first place. Most investors or financiers of projects, not just renewables, but natural gas, coal, nuclear as well, they want to feel confident that they're going to get paid back for their investment. So for the most part, they tend to require some sort of power purchase agreement, perhaps for the full output of a plant. Sometimes it can be for a portion of the plant. This is required so they feel confident that over the period of time they're getting paid back, which is the time of the contract, so it can be out to 25 years, they feel confident that they're going to get the return that they are hoping on and counting on. Of course, things happen, and that doesn't always happen, so they're trying to be risk-averse. And to the extent that it's anyone who's giving a loan, a bank who is giving a loan, they have even stricter requirements as well. So the next key concept is the Public Utility Commission. This is the state regulatory agency that oversees retail utility rates. They govern investor-owned utility decisions about new generation, transmission, and distribution. It's important to note it doesn't include municipal utilities or rural co-ops. They have their own governance structure that, for the most part, is not governed by the state PUC. They look short and long term as well. They try to figure out if the utility is making good decisions that are least cost in general for the ratepayers. And they also want to make sure that the grid reliability is maintained. So they're also called public service commissions. So with that, I'll hand it over to David, who will walk us through the IRP process.
Okay, thank you, Carlin, and appreciate being here with y'all to discuss some of the changes that are taking place in the electric sector right now. I mean, Carlin teed up some of the main players and the main pieces. What I'd like to do right now is to talk a little bit about how these are all fitting together, what sort of processes are in play, and particularly how the electric sector is changing, because there are some dynamics that are affecting the parties that are bringing projects in for permitting, processes and changes in the sector that have a profound effect on the need for the projects and the viability of the projects. So I want to kind of go through all of these things and give you a sense of essentially what's going on behind the scenes with these projects that are coming in for permitting. Most utilities, particularly in the western United States, are engaged in what's called integrated resource planning, the IRP process. This is where they take a 5 to 10 year look ahead to anticipate what sort of capacity additions they will need. Not only generating capacity, but will they need additional transmission? Are there some reliability issues that require some sort of an upgrade? A number of concepts really underlie the resource planning process. Perhaps the most pivotal idea is future reserve margins, operating reserve margins. This is the difference between what the utility anticipates its maximum demand level is going to be during a typical year and the amount of generating resources that it has online. So a utility is going to want to have maybe 10, 15, 17 more percent generating capacity, peak generating capacity, than what its peak demand is likely to be during the given year, during the hour of the year where you have the most air conditioners turned on, the most lights turned on, the most activity, that the highest level of demand on that system, that hourly demand, is what they calibrate their system fleet towards, and being able to meet that hour. Because if they run short on capacity, then there are reliability issues and potentially even blackouts. So that's the benchmark for integrated resource planning. One element of that is their existing fleet. They look at what they have on the ground right now, how it's operating. Are there any units that are getting so old or so economically inefficient that it's just not cost effective to run them anymore? This is the process where this is the point where they look at the desirability of retiring units because it's just not cost effective to run them anymore. Increasingly, a lot of utilities are also looking at the need to add emission controls and how that would affect the economic viability of a given unit. If a coal unit is kind of marginal economics anyway, it's not being run very often. It's just being, the utility just keeps it around for reliability reasons. It's there to run in case they need it, in case something else goes out. If continuing to keep that unit online requires adding scrubbers or adding catalytic reduction or some other environmental control, that's going to change the economics of keeping that plant around. And so the utility has to evaluate the cost and the benefits of making those upgrades and simply turning to something else and retiring that plant. They'll also look at their forecasted load growth. And this is an important changing dimension of the electric sector, particularly in the West. If you look back to the 1960s and 1970s and into the 1980s, a lot of coal capacity was added, even some nuclear capacity in California and in Arizona were added. And they were added on the anticipation of continued load growth. Demand was growing on order of 3, 4, 5% per year, and so the utilities were having to anticipate that growth and make sure that they had the generating capacity online in time to meet that demand. This led to a lot of the large coal and nuclear plants that you see around the West: Colstrip, Jim Bridger, Navajo, and even the Mojave plant. A lot of those came online in the 1970s in response to load growth. A lot of this capacity was owned by the utility, which meant that the capital costs were paid for directly by ratepayers. And we'll come back to this in a minute because this is another aspect of how the sector is changing. But it was load growth that drove a lot of those major capacity expansions. Today, load is not growing as much, and in fact, in many states, there is no growth at all. Demand is keeping fairly flat. This affects the resource planning process because capacity expansion is not so much a response to load growth, but to other drivers, such as the need to retire capacity due to environmental controls. In the IRP process, the existing resources are evaluated and compared with the addition of new resources. And as Carlin mentioned, there's also demand-side resources. Utilities are more methodically adding what's called demand response, which is, you know, for example, if you've got a large customer that you know, say a coal or a steel smelter, 500 megawatts that is not consumed is the same as 500 megawatts that is generated and put onto the system. So there is an economic benefit to providing compensation to the steel mill to change the time of day that it operates, so it's not smelting during peak hours. That has a value to the utility and to customers on the system. Once the needs are determined and the utility figures out whether or not to add its own capacity or whether there are better market opportunities out there, it decides what types of resources are going to be put out for bid for a power purchase agreement. It takes these plans, this bundle of plans in its IRP to the PUC. It's vetted. The public has an opportunity to comment. This is where a lot of assumptions about future needs are vetted with the regulators and the PUCs. And the PUC then ultimately accepts or amends the resource plan. So the IRP then becomes kind of the guideline going forward. No actual investments are approved in the IRP process, but the IRP does serve as kind of the framework by which specific projects are evaluated going forward. With that approved, then particular projects coming in, specific projects come in, IRP purchase agreements are signed, and interconnection begins, transmission upgrades are undertaken. So that's basically how the IRP process works. Most utilities do this every 2 or 3 years, as I said, looking ahead on a 5 to 10 year basis, and it's a continuing planning cycle. Next slide. Now, increasingly, utilities are looking at power purchase agreements. As I said, back in the 70s, a lot of the additional capacity was owned by the utility. When the utility owns its own capacity, it's the capital cost is folded into the utility's rates. So regardless of how much that capacity is used, there's always a guarantee that the utility will recover enough revenue from rates to pay off the capital cost. Now, that's very different from a power purchase agreement. A PPA is an agreement with a merchant provider, somebody who is not a utility in most cases, and that merchant provider does not have a guaranteed customer base and the ability to collect rates from that customer base. They are basically taking on the risk of recovering the capital costs. And all of that risk has to be folded into the power purchase agreement. So the utility determines through its IRP process what it's going to need in terms of purchase power. And in most cases, it will put out a request for proposals, take the most cost-effective bid, and negotiate a deal with the winning bidder, and then that agreement is then taken to the regulators, to the PUC for final approval. Once the PUC approves it, then the utility can get cost recovery through its rates through that PPA. In some cases, there will be a sole source agreement. If there's a particularly attractive project that one developer or one merchant provider might be in a unique position to provide. And this goes through the same approval process. In all cases, whether it's a competitive bid or whether it's a sole source arrangement, the ability to recover revenue from rates to pay for that contract has to be approved by the regulators. Next slide. Now, the state regulators, the state public utility commissions, have a particular role in this. And when you get into parsing out how regulatory authority happens, it gets pretty complicated, because back in the old days, a utility would pretty much serve customers in a given territory within a given state. Starting in the 1990s and really accelerating in 2000 and going forward, wholesale power markets have become more interstate in nature, and that has raised that has kind of shifted part of the electric sector from state and local regulation to federal jurisdiction because of the interstate commerce issues involved. So it leads to a rather complicated division of authority between states and the federal government with respect to who regulates what. As a general rule, anything that involves interstate commerce is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This includes most transmission investments in the United States. So the ability to recover costs from customers to cover the cost of new transmission has to be approved by the federal government. Resource decisions, anything that involves rates that are charged to local retail customers, that is regulated by the state PUCs. Now, state PUCs, in many cases, do have authority over line siting. For example, if a utility wants to build a transmission line from Wyoming to Oregon, that siting, those siting questions will be reviewed by the state public utility commissions. What the state PUCs cannot do is to make any determination about the rates that are charged by the utility. That is federal jurisdiction. Distribution wires, things at a lower voltage that connect to your house, to your office, those are local decisions and the local investments that are really regulated by the state PUCs. Okay, next. So with this complicated array of regulatory authority and the changing nature of the electric sector as a whole, the world does not look as simple from a planning perspective as it did 40 years ago. And that has an impact on what the likely scenario of future renewable energy growth is going to be. And there are a lot of question marks about what that future is going to be. Carlin mentioned the states that have renewable portfolio standards. These are quantitative requirements for obtaining a certain percentage of electricity from renewable resources. A lot of the IRP planning that is taking place right now is pegged to the end date of many of these RPSs, which come to fruition in 2020, 2025. So, with respect to planning renewable energy acquisitions, a lot of those plans are pegged to whatever that ultimate amount of renewable energy has to be at that time. Very little planning takes place, looks at acquisitions past the RPS requirement. And so it's a really big question mark what the market for renewables will look like on the other side of those RPS requirements. Now, some utilities have found that they can procure wind power at costs that are, in some cases, lower than the cost of natural gas. It's uncertain in 2020, 2025, what will natural gas look like? It's very difficult to predict what future costs will look like at that time. So that's one uncertainty. Another uncertainty would be what the effect of environmental regulations will be. EPA will be promulgating emission requirements for mercury, for air toxics. Eventually, they'll also have to look at regulations for greenhouse gas emissions. That's going to have an impact on particularly the coal fleet. How many of those coal units will retire and how many of them will have to be replaced, and how will that compare to future load growth or lack of load growth, as that may be turning out. A number of factors will affect the transmission upgrades required to accommodate additional renewables. One is grid integration. How will the variability be managed on the system? Is there going to be a preference for distributed generation to the extent that distributed solar takes off because of cost reductions? Will that affect the amount of renewables that would be needed via the high voltage transmission system? So there are a lot of uncertainties that utilities are having to weigh in their planning processes that are affecting the types of projects that they are bringing out for permitting to various federal agencies.
And David, if I can make one point on the coal retirements and the EPA regulations, it's interesting and sometimes surprising for people to hear that even just the discussions that are happening can cause a change in what the investors feel comfortable with. So even if there isn't a law on the books, to the extent that there are conversations and bills being proposed and whatnot, the investors who were, as we mentioned, are talking about like a 2025 year investment, they're very concerned because it seems like sometime in that time frame their investment might be impacted. And so I think that's part of the reason why lately we haven't seen as many new coal plants being proposed. There have been some, and some of them have had some pretty severe environmental controls on them. But it's interesting because we don't know, which way Congress is going to go and whether there's going to be climate change legislation. But even just the discussion of it can impact the direction of investment. So I just wanted to point that out for people unfamiliar with that.
And that's really fascinating because there are really two sources of uncertainty there that are deterring a lot of the investment. Part of it is the additional cost that would come about from whatever the legislation is. But probably more than that is the fact that there's just so much uncertainty about what that's going to be. A lot of utilities will say, we can deal with whatever that cost is, but just tell us what that cost is. Give us a cost of carbon that we can plan around. But if that cost is just kind of moving up and down every week because of political uncertainty, there isn't a number for them to plan around. And so that, in many cases, is an even greater deterrent to investment than just the potential for additional cost.
Yeah, because the investors are always going to assume the worst. They're always going to assume that whatever the cost is, they're going to look only at the maximum range because that's what they're going to feel comfortable with, or they might just avoid certain technologies or whatnot. So
right, and the danger for them is once the costs are sunk, they're sunk.
Right.
If they've put $1 billion into some sort of a capital investment, they can't take that back. So
and yet they have to try to make back their money.
Right.
Even if they have to make additional investments of new pollution control that weren't in the initial investment. So.
And we're seeing that a lot. We're seeing that crop up with respect to pollution controls and new environmental upgrades. For example, at the in a number of coal plants that are having to address NOx emissions, the most expensive and most effective technology costs about 10 times the cost of the second most effective technology. So the question is, you know, if they put those higher efficiency technologies on, then that means that the coal plant has to operate at least another 15 or 20 years in order to recoup those investments. In New Mexico, there was a deal negotiated on one of the coal plants there where the trade-off was to put the second most efficient controls on that didn't cost as much, which would not require the remaining coal units to operate as long as they otherwise would have had they put on the more expensive technology. So there are a lot of moving parts to this. What I'd like to do is just stop right now and hand it back to Courtney, and Carlin and I will take whatever questions you all have.
Thank you, David and Carlin. Now we'll go ahead and get into the questions and answer session, as David had mentioned. And like I said before, you can submit your questions by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen, and we will get to as many questions as time allows. We do have a few questions that have come up. And let's see. Are all IRP processes about transmission only, generation only, or both?
Both.
Both.
Now, utilities do it differently across the West, and that's one issue that is being discussed in various regional forums for regional transmission planning. Is there some benefit into kind of harmonizing the IRP approaches that that various utilities take? Because when you sort of look at transmission needs that span several utility territories, at some point they've got to get on the same page about what they need and who's going to pay for it. So it really has a big impact on cost allocation. I should also point out that part of the changes in the wholesale power sector that have taken place over the past 10 to 15 years have affected different parts of the country in different ways. So if you look at the West, Western utilities rely a lot on integrated resource planning. If you go to the Eastern interconnection in Eastern states, a lot of those areas are part of what's called regional transmission organizations, where transmission planning is not done by an individual utility. It's done by the entire regional transmission organization as a whole. And that affects the transmission upgrades, and it affects the way new generating capacity is added. So it's a different story if you go to an Eastern RTO than to the West.
Yeah, and I'd also add that the question is good because it thinks about generation and transmission. Not all of the utilities include demand side options. So some of them just focus on supply side options. That's changing. But if one of the advantages that is seen with these demand side options of having reducing load at peak times is you might actually be able to defer additional generation plants and therefore additional transmission as well. So it's not consistently done. So again, those conversations about how to do things a little more consistently over a larger area are important.
Great. I have another one here. Why do projects in California take an extra 5 years in general to approve versus a similar project in neighboring states like Oregon or Nevada?
California. So California is very interesting in that they try to be incredibly rigorous. They have not only a Public Utility Commission, they also have the California Energy Commission. And so they have a number of laws and regulations that must be followed, many of which are, focused around sustainability and permitting and siting and interconnection and really trying to, protect wildlife and make sure that the processes in place are quite rigorous. So because of that, going through the process of the initial concept of a transmission line to it being live and in operation, when you just lay out all the pieces and all the paperwork that need to be done, I heard it from the PUC themselves. They said, yeah, if everything goes perfectly, it'll take 10 years. But usually something happens, so it usually takes longer than that. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing right now, a real upswell for renewable electricity that's on the distribution side, because you don't have to build the transmission. It kind of makes it a little easier for them to meet their RPSs, and they're looking at some what I call wholesale distributed generation as well, larger, 1 to 10 megawatt plants that you don't have to put on the transmission system. You can interconnect it to the distribution system, so you may be able to avoid that long process.
Another thing is the fact that there's so many more people in California than elsewhere in the West. If you are trying to add a 200-mile transmission line and you're going past 200 homeowners, then you're going to have more interveners than you are if you're trying to run 200 miles through Wyoming and you've got two ranchers.
So
you're going to have more people intervening, more potential for delay through litigation, and so California just simply has to be more careful procedurally. That's in addition to the additional environmental regulations, the state environmental regulations that they have to make sure developers comply with. There are a lot of factors that delay the process in California. Now, it'll be interesting to see how this meshes with California's ultimate goal. California has the most ambitious renewable energy requirement in the country, 33% by 2020. And so one of the questions that they are going to, what they have been grappling with is how much of that should come from California, how much should they obtain from other states if it can be obtained more cost effectively through efficient transmission. The California statute allows for a certain portion of that to come from out of state, but costs are going to be very key to how that shakes out.
Okay. How much line siting authority does the state PUC really have in cases of pass-through merchant transmission with no power connections in that state?
They definitely have authority to stop projects, to support or stop. Because I guess I'm just thinking about there's a transmission project, and the line is I think it's like clean path or clear path, and it's trying to go from the west to the southeast, and it wanted to pass through a state. And I'm not sure if it was the PUC that had the authority or not, but the state was able to say, we don't want that transmission line to come through our state, especially if we're not going to get any of the benefits of having what's called a drop. So an actual point where it's interconnected into the local transmission and distribution system. It was just going to be a line that would pass through, which it seems like that's what the question is about. So I know that is a challenge, and it's something where I believe, FERC doesn't claim eminent domain to cut through a state. I think it's something where the state definitely has rights for determining what is built and what isn't. What do you have to add there, David?
The problem in the West is that states do it differently. Colorado does it one way. It has some authority that's allowed to states local authorities, but then the state PUC is a forum for appeal you say a local government denies a permit. So the regulatory framework is different across the West. There is a paper that I think would be very helpful, and I'm sorry we don't have that listed on our presentation, but the paper is called Transmission Siting White Paper. And if you do a Google search, Holland and Hart is the law firm that that pulled it together. Holland and Hart Transmission Siting White Paper, that should take you to it. But it's a very good general description of what siting laws are in each state with respect to transmission being built by the regulated utilities, merchant transmission, tie line transmission to merchant plants. So I think probably a good tool for addressing this sort of question would be to obtain that white paper from Holland and Hart.
Right. How does FERC fit into transmission decisions?
FERC primarily evaluates the cost and the setting of transmission rates. If you go back, 40 years or so, when utilities primarily served territories within a state, costs were regulated within the context of that state. But because aspects of the utility sector are now interstate, such as transmission, the accounting for all of the costs that the utility has are much more complicated. FERC has a system of accounting by which a utility will take all of its costs and parse them out between what is FERC jurisdictional and what is not FERC jurisdictional. So all of the costs that are involved in expanding transmission or upgrading transmission or maintaining transmission, those fall under FERC jurisdiction, and FERC determines whether or not the transmission rates that the utility charges are just and reasonable, and it determines that on the basis of the cost that the utility can demonstrate to FERC. Once FERC approves that the costs are prudent, then they go into rates. Now, once FERC has determined a transmission rate for a utility, that basically takes the question out of the hands of any state regulator. States have to basically accept those rates as FERC has determined them to be just and reasonable. They can determine the need for buying power across a particular transmission path and, whether or not the utility needs that power to serve its customers. But the state PUC cannot revisit that rate. It cannot question what FERC has decided with respect to what a just and reasonable rate is.
Okay, we have a few more questions here. Like I mentioned before, if you have any questions, go ahead and type it into the questions pane. What happens if the load forecast shows no load growth?
Then the main driver for any transmission addition or generation addition is going to be retirement. Are there units that are just so? Do you have some old dogs out there that are just so uneconomic that it's best to just put them out of their misery and shut them down? If you're losing capacity due to retirements, then you're going to have to replace that capacity, even if your load is not growing. The second potential driver is going to be how the cost of existing coal units change due to environmental regulations and and environmental controls that may be required under mercury and air toxics, under greenhouse gas controls. Those are going to change the economics, and if that makes a coal unit uneconomic, the utility may select to retire that unit, and in which case it would have to add something else.
Okay. It looks like we have one more question here. You said state PUCs can't second-guess transmission rate decisions made by FERC. What's the reasoning behind that, and how does it work?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's that's the separation between commerce that happens within the state and interstate commerce. So whatever happens in the realm of interstate commerce, the Constitution provides that as that is something that is not under state control. It's federally regulated, and the principle that I mentioned before of a rate determined by FERC to be just and reasonable, there's a principle called the filed rate doctrine. And what that means is that once FERC approves a rate to be included in a utility's transmission tariff, that is essentially a set cost that that enters into any state regulatory decision about what the cost of delivered power is going to be. So, for example, if a utility in California determines that it has to get power from Nevada to serve its customers, the utility can determine how much power needs to come across the transmission lines in Nevada. It has the flexibility to determine that, but the rates that that are charged for delivering that power, those are set by federal tariff, and there's nothing the state can do to change that, change the rates that are charged.
Okay, well, thank you, David. Here are some of the sources, or here are a few of the sources that were used for this presentation today. I would like to take this time to thank our speakers, Carlin Corey and David Hurlbut, and I'd like to thank the Bureau of Land Management as well for their time today. We will send an email to all of the webinar participants with the link to the presentation files. If you have any further questions for the Bureau of Land Management, please contact someone on the slide that's shown on your screen right now. And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for participating, and goodbye.